Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Shattered Silence, Stories of Recovery and Resilience. My name is Jory, and today I am here with Zach Scow. Zach, thank you for being here.
You are so very welcome.
Zach is founder of Positive Change and Marley's Mutts. So we're going to kind of talk a little bit about that. But first, we're going to go back into your backstory.
Let's get into it.
Start from the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you grew up in, was it Tehachapi?
No, I grew up in Hermosa Beach, California.
Oh, okay.
90254.
Okay. Yeah. So how was life growing up?
I had a remarkable childhood. I had a very interesting kind of childhood growing up at the beach. I'm a twin. My birth is very kind of interesting in that we were 2 months premature. My mom was an executive at ABC and Disney. And when we were born, we were very, very sick kids. And my twin brother, we were less than 8 pounds combined when we were born. We had all kinds of different medical issues, underdeveloped lungs. And we were in the hospital for my brother for 2 months plus and myself for over a month at Cedars-Sinai. And one of the interesting stories is that in our youth, in our very like formative years, we got word from Cedars that a person had passed who had donated blood to so many of the neonates that were at the hospital. So he had died of HIV/AIDS, and all of us, I was born in 79, so there was nothing known about HIV/AIDS or testing for HIV or any of these things. So all of a sudden, our family gets the scare of a lifetime, you know, that we might have been tainted. And so there was testing, specifically with my brother, you know, for years until that kind of red flag was worked out and we knew we were out of the woods. But yeah, I was definitely in, you know, now what I know now, having gone to therapy and everything, certainly having the first months of your life been in a hospital where you're not being held, you're not being cared for, you're in an incubator.
Yeah.
The pulse ox was invented while we were in the NICU, which was really interesting. You know, we used to have this cup with a needle on top of your head that drew your blood every hour to give you an oxygen rating, your oxygen saturation. And then right as we were leaving the NICU, the pulse ox was invented, the little thing that just goes over your finger and it gives you a constant. And then
missed that one, huh?
Yeah. And then oddly enough, many years later, you know, 28 years later, I would be admitted to the comprehensive transplant program at Cedars-Sinai, the same hospital I was born at. But yeah, Hermosa Beach, to get into Hermosa is a very interesting place to grow up. You know, we came from a broken home. So our parents separated when we were 6 months old, and that's all we ever knew. I don't have any recollection of our parents being together, and we were latchkey kids. So we got home from school. We walked ourselves to school, got home from school. There's no parents, you know, we're just doing our thing and kind of raised by the beach. Yeah. And I remember when my mom always tells a story when we got really close to the beach, when we moved right near the beach. I grew up in a house with two single moms and their families. So it was my mom and then Sue, another mom, and her kid. So it was a very unique kind of upbringing. And when we moved down to the beach, you know, like right near the strand, I remember my mom telling us, you know, all right, kids, no going to the beach by yourselves. No going to the ocean by yourselves. You know, you're 8 years old. We get it. But I better not see you down by the beach by yourself without an adult, okay? Mm-hmm. So she comes home that day after work, and we're nowhere to be found. And she comes running down the beach and, you know, to meet Zachary Mead Scow, Jeffrey Wagner Scow, what are you doing down here at the beach? I told you guys not to be down here unless you're with an adult. And my brother goes, Mom, look around. There's adults everywhere.
Oh, my gosh. So,
and that was kind
of that's a smart take there.
Yeah, and that's the way it works. You know, we really just spent our time skateboarding and you know, rollerblading and biking and causing trouble around the South Bay. And yeah, I mean, you know, alcohol and drugs in terms of the culture of using where I'm from, you know, alcohol was mandatory, certainly in my family and within my friend circles, just socially at the South Bay. South Bay is Redondo, Manhattan, Hermosa. And it's just very much so a culture of drinking and partying hard and fighting. And, you know, we had, you know, parties every weekend, and all those parties ended in fights. And it was just kind of a raucous, wild place to grow up for sure. But I loved it. It's a very special place. It's still where I feel the most comfortable. You know, when I kind of get west of PCH into the South Bay, you know, my blood pressure, everything kind of just, that's where I feel the most at home. Not that I don't feel at home in Kern County or in Tehachapi either. It was just, it was a very wonderful, unique, interesting place to grow up, but not a lot of parental involvement. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah. So I'm sure as you got into high school, it was still all the partying.
Yeah. So I went to San Diego State, and out of high school, And I knew I was an alcoholic. I started drinking, you know, my parents drank every day that I knew them, mm-hmm. you know, habitually, alcoholically, both of them. Mm-hmm. So I always only knew alcohol. And I always thought to myself, you know, I always kind of tracked my life as, when am I going to be able to start drinking like mm-hmm. them? When am I going to be able to start? And there was times where I messed around with it really early on, you know, 11, 12, just mm-hmm. stealing alcohol out of the fridge and out of the icebox. We had one of those old school antique ice boxes filled with hard liquor. So it was definitely, you know, a big part of where I was trying to go was like to develop a relationship with alcohol. I really thought that was a big part of adulthood. Mm-hmm. And I think by the time I was 17, I knew I was an alcoholic, if I'm being honest.
Man, yeah.
Yeah, like I was very aware of it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that was necessarily a negative thing. Like I more so knew that I had a deep dependency on alcohol. And I was okay with that. And I loved the way it made me feel. You know, I think I always really struggled with who I was and what I saw of myself compared to what other people saw of myself. And like I had this moniker of like golden boy is what they would call me. And I never felt like the golden boy. I never felt like what other people were seeing. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of expectations for this, that, and the other. And I had expectations of myself, family, friends, et cetera. I probably made it a lot worse than it was, but alcohol seemed to help me cope with who I was and what I really had a hard time with. And at that age too, you're starting to, you know, I was starting to get a lot of performance anxiety in terms of sports and in terms of school. Mm-hmm. I always was very good scholastically. I was in all AP classes. But I just had a hard time with failure. I had a hard time with letting people down, letting myself down. You know, I had all this capability from a sports standpoint that I couldn't really execute. I couldn't really mm-hmm. deliver. And had some other things in terms of, you know, childhood sexual interactions that really scared me. I didn't know what was fear at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're a young child and you're going through puberty and you're developing your, you know, who you are, mm-hmm. There was just, without elaborating, there were certain situations that really traumatized me in terms of intimacy and being around adults mm-hmm. And really people of the opposite sex. I was terrified of women, terrified. Yeah. You know, you go through things as a child, I went through some things as a child related to women that were very traumatizing that I didn't know how to escape. And therefore, whenever I was around girls at the time, because I was a kid, it would conjure up these feelings of fight or flight. And it was flight. I needed to get out of that situation. I just felt horrifically uncomfortable. So when you're a young man, boy, and you're coming through puberty and you're coming into your own, yet you're terrified of the opposite sex and terrified, not in like a typical healthy, naturally scared, intimidated, precocious, like, you know, it was terrifying. And I never knew why that was happening. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I just knew something was wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And the only way I could cope with that was alcohol. And it helped me tremendously. You know, it helped me be funnier. Like I said, we had a lot of like fights growing up. I'm not saying we were like the gnarliest people, but there were just a lot of fights where we grew up. It was mm-hmm. like every weekend. And so it helps you participate in that mm-hmm. frequency of just being kind of a gnarly kid and being a little more over the top than you might be. But it's a beautiful place. You know, it is a unique, beautiful place. And I'm really grateful for a lot of my childhood.
Yeah.
Not so grateful for the culture that was imprinted into me in terms of values around alcohol and things like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a really wonderful, unique place to grow up.
Yeah. And I'm sure like growing up, just because alcohol was all you were around alcohol a lot. You probably didn't see it at a young age as a problem at all.
I saw it as a necessity to being an adult. Mm-hmm. I saw mastering your relationship with alcohol as a prerequisite to adulthood. You know, mm-hmm. you developed and nurtured your relationship with alcohol so that you could be a better adult, because that's what adults do. Yeah. They get together and they drink. So if you're good at that, you're good at being an adult. I very much equated like being a good drinker with a critically important to being a good adult.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah,
too.
So I always really, and then I would pride myself in how good of a drinker I was,
yeah.
you know, and how much alcohol I could consume, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Know? It was completely ludicrous looking back on it. But when you see all the adults around you constantly consuming alcohol, you know, what's a kid supposed to do?
Yeah.
But assume that that's the gateway to adulthood.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Aspire Counseling Services provides caring, personalized support for adults and teens facing mental health challenges. From group therapy to mindfulness, art, and even pet therapy, their programs are designed to help people feel better and build healthier habits. Teens can get the support they need while still keeping up with school and home life. You can reach Aspire at 888-585-7373. So after you had this experience as a kid, though, or a young adult, I guess, your sexual experience, did you talk to anybody about it?
No.
So
no,
that I was something that was just broken. Kept to yourself.
Yeah. It wasn't until therapy and sobriety. I was probably 30.
Much later.
I was probably 30. And, you know, it comes across when you're speaking to a therapist and you're just sharing with them things that happened to you, what your role was in your childhood, you know, how your family dynamic was. And you get to sharing some of these things. And then, you know, you see your therapist kind of sit back. And I remember the session because she just, it felt like she was almost like in shock. She kept going like, and then what happened?
Yeah.
You know, it was like, is this a podcast interview or are you trying to, you know, help me get to the root of my
like
issues?
I don't need that reaction from you.
Yeah, it was a bit strange. And then, you know, we spent weeks kind of working through that. And it wasn't something I wanted to originally address. I didn't agree with her assessment. Mm-hmm. You know, again, when you're a young man who is trying to step into his power as a young man in a household that doesn't have a, you know, my mom didn't have a significant other. Mm-hmm. There was no other men around. You're trying to occupy a certain role. And trying to occupy that role precluded me from like really understanding what had occurred, mm-hmm. you know. But now that I've, you know, is one of the most cathartic, wonderful releases that I ever had in therapy because I just thought I was broken. You know, I just thought something was so wrong with me. And then now I'm going to remove alcohol from my life so I don't have that crutch that's like helping me address this. So what am I going to do? And it really takes the power away. When you can speak something and reflect on it and unpack it with a therapist and kind of have them help understand what the underlying realities are there, it is really, I mean, catharsis isn't just like an irrational expression of emotions. It's like how you move through real experiences. And I was able to like really move through that and kind of understand. And once you understand why you are a certain way or the catalysts in life that push you into a certain way, it's so much easier to be graceful with yourself. And it was so much easier for me to be like, okay, all right, you've been through some things and they've affected you in the following ways. And here's how we're going to address it moving forward. And honestly, just getting it out in the open and speaking it with another person really helped set me free.
And honestly, just probably get a little bit more understanding of yourself too. You know, you're a kid, you don't have any answers to all these things. And so I'm sure therapy helped a lot.
Yeah, it really did. And you know, not only is therapy like, I have the best relationship with my mom I could hope for. I have an incredible relationship with my dad. I mean, it's not without its ups and downs and it's, you know, but generally speaking, and I also know how to repair things should they go astray, mm-hmm. you know, and I think working with a therapist really helps equip you with the tools to be able to have tough conversations and have, I don't know, boundaries are also difficult to implement, you know, especially in sobriety. Mm-hmm. So it kind of helps you with all these elements of practicing life.
Mm-hmm. So going through life, mm-hmm. When did you realize that the alcohol had become too much?
Oh, man, that's a funny question. I mean, I kind of knew all along. I got kicked out of college. I moved to Tucson, got into hard drugs, you know, cocaine, crack cocaine. I was living in an apartment where a lot of crack was being sold and produced, you know, so we had, you know, pots and pans and dishes that were being microwaved, stovetop. It was like a factory of drugs, you know. And so that introduced me to that frequency of hard drugs and that lifestyle, which was exhilarating, but also terrifying. And also took me well into the counterculture and outside of like wherever I thought I was headed. You know, once you get involved in that kind of a frequency, it pulls you in. And by that point, too, I was an admitted alcoholic. Like, I knew I needed alcohol to function. I was just drinking every night. Mm-hmm. But to answer your question, the way things really, like, unraveled is I got in a car accident in 2003, and I broke my sternum. I rolled my truck off of a cliff and, you know, it rolled into this ravine. I got knocked out, hurt myself real bad, and then kind of woke up and walked home.
Oh my gosh.
But that was to cope with the pain of a fractured sternum and broken, you know, shoulder. It I started to drink 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So I was consuming alcohol constantly, you know, whenever I'd wake up first thing in the morning, in the shower, after I get dressed, like just to try to maintain. And when I had tried to get off, like 6 months later, I tried to, I'm going to go just one day. I'm just going to smoke some weed.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a good boy. Mm-hmm. And the rude awakening, when you try to take yourself off of alcohol, it is such, and you're physically addicted and spiritually, emotionally addicted, it is a rude awakening. It is such a terrifying, I had done such a good job of keeping alcohol in my body that when I tried to get off of it, you know, the physical issues I could deal with, shaking, vomiting, but it was the existential discomfort. Like I was so uncomfortable, you know, just like terrified to be in my own skin. And I couldn't get through that night. For as soon as the liquor stores opened at 6, I was there just getting a fix, just yeah. so I could survive, just so I could be normal.
Yeah.
You know, so it all came to a head. You know, my relationship with alcohol started to become obviously treacherous when I started to turn yellow and I started to turn purple. You know, I was bruising really, really easily. My stomach started to get really big, and then my belly button herniated, and I'm starting to get stretch marks on my side, and my belly's getting bigger and bigger, and my eyes are yellow, my skin is yellow. I look kind of grayish orange. And I just hit it. I just fibbed. You know, I wore long shirts and baggy clothes and sunglasses, and I would tan outside so you couldn't – I looked more like tan than yellow, and just trying to cover it up because I knew something was bad. It's wild the delusions you'll put yourself under when you're facing out, you know, issues with alcoholism. I just told myself I can't live without alcohol, and I couldn't. There was no me. It's really difficult to express this to people who've never been physically addicted to a chemical or a drug, but there just wasn't any me without alcohol. And trying to have that conversation, trying to justify being alive without it, was ludicrous. Like if you just understood how inexorably connected to this chemical I am, and how, you know, if this ends, I end. There's no point in me being around, because I couldn't deal with the narrative in my mind. I couldn't deal with the trouncing around in the neighborhood between my ears. You know, it was just a very dangerous place to be in my head. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea how to cope with that other than alcohol. So, you know, I started to leak. You know, when you're in liver failure, you start to bleed because your blood won't clot. So I'm bleeding out of my mouth. I'm bleeding out of my rear end, and this is constant, you know. So I went to the doctor, and she said, and she started like petting my hand, and she said, "Honey, you're in liver failure and you need to go to a hospital immediately." And I was like, "Nah, you know, I just tied one on." Mm-hmm. I just got rip roaring shit face this last weekend. You don't understand, we're fine. She's yeah. like, "No, honey, this is not how this works. For it to come up in your blood test like this, here's your AST, your ALT, your bilirubin, your albumin. Here's all of these things are as bad as they could be. And you could die soon. And you need to go to a hospital immediately." And so I, like any good alcoholic, I just lied about it. I just did the same thing. Yeah. Went home and completely lied about it. Because that meant the end of me. Like coming to grips with what that nurse had just said meant the end of my life. There's no me without alcohol. And I'm certainly not ready or willing to face liver failure. Yeah. You know, what I can't face my own thoughts. How am I supposed to face this type of a reality? You know, I was just such a child, such a kid when it came to coping, when it came to understanding how to push through difficult things. And so, yeah, I just lied about it. And then pretty quickly I became unable to lie about it because I was so obviously physically ill. You know, you just look so sick.
Yeah. Did you have any support? Like, were you in a relationship or so you?
No, my dad was my support.
Yeah.
Yeah. My dad was God as I understood him before I developed a relationship with God. And I mean that because he was the only bit of hope that I had. You know, my dad was unconditionally there for me to try to help get me through this. Although he didn't understand much of what was going on, he knew that it was his responsibility to do it. It's a really kind of beautiful story of what parents are willing to do for their kids.
Yeah.
Despite not understanding what's happening and also vehemently disagreeing with just about every part of your life, you know. But yeah, he admitted me. He took me down to Bakersfield Memorial in, I think it was August 1st, 2008, and they admitted me for long-term care, you know, and I spent almost 6 weeks there. First thing the doctor said when they came in is, your son needs a liver transplant and he's not going to get one. You know, you needed 6 months of sobriety just to qualify for liver transplant. I didn't have 6 hours of sobriety. Yeah. And I'm in full liver failure. And my kidneys went south. There was a period there where they stabilized my kidneys. I don't really remember a lot of the beginning week mm-hmm. of being there. And then, you know, so I went through alcohol withdrawal in the hospital, went through all that. Again, not remembering much. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they at the time it was pain management was the policy. And what pain management really means is, we will give you all the drugs you require to be high and comfortable. And they have a pain chart on the wall, and it's a smiley face, a straight yeah. face, a frowny face, and a frowny crying face. If you point at the frowny crying face, they're going to hook you up every 3 to 4 hours with shots of Dilaudid. And so that, I very quickly got addicted to drugs in the hospital. I was going through every mechanism to try to stabilize my body. I was in frozen plasma transfusions. They're trying to get my INR low enough to be able to do a liver biopsy, but I'm just done. My gallbladder, pancreas, had pancreatitis, you know, I'm in complete, it's called end stage liver disease, end stage liver failure. Man. So it's not like, they don't call it stage four. You know, you either die or you get a transplant. And what I needed was a transplant, and there was no way I was going to get one. So I just sat in that hospital for weeks, getting sicker, abusing my nurses because I was so addicted to drugs in there, and watching Angels reruns and Cesar Millan Dog Whisper in the middle of the night in that hospital room. And it was a very, very dark time. My dad was the one person there, you know, really trying to advocate for me, trying to figure out a way to get me into one of the 7 transplant hospitals. Mm-hmm. And there was just no point. It just wasn't happening. And then they finally got to a point where they're trying to kick me out on, you know, hospice care. Insurance is saying, hey, we can't just keep paying for this guy to be in the hospital. He's been there for a long time. You know, if this isn't working, it's time for him to go home with his family and let him pass. And we ended up, my dad just would not say no. You know, my dad is an engineer who focuses on solving problems and taking in data and understanding boundary conditions. And that's what he did, is he just would not give up. And we got a relationship that he developed with a nurse at UCLA who said, look, I got you basically a meeting with the transplant hospital at Cedars. If you can be there in a handful of hours, you will... You know, this is the best shot for you to get into a transplant hospital. And again, the prerequisites are you need to have 6 months of sobriety. I did not have that. But they said they would meet me. So we pulled everything out against doctor's orders. You know, the doctors are saying you can't leave here. You know, you're not. Yeah. He's extremely fragile. My dad said, you know, I know what I'm doing. I'm taking him out of here. And signed all the paperwork against doctor's orders and sped me down. And at the time, too, when you're in liver failure, you have ammonia on your brain. So you're like completely incoherent. Yeah. You know, you go between relatively present and aware to totally checked out. You don't know what day it is. You're unbalanced. You can't talk right. Mm-hmm. You're very cloudy. And we had that meeting, all female transplant team, and Dr. Tran admitted me to the transplant program, which is amazing. And then admitted me into Cedars-Sinai. And then she said, look, if we keep you here, you're going to die. And I don't want you to die here. So I'm going to send you home with your dad. And you need to stay near an emergency room. I laugh because I have to think about how screwed up this was for my dad. I don't reflect enough on how tough it is to have a child of yours, a grown male child in liver failure, and then being told, all right, he's going home with you. And we live in the middle of the mountains. There's no hospital. The closest hospitals at the time, Tehachapi Hospital, was this little teeny hole in the wall. Mm-hmm. And I had already been there. And my dad's going, what? You're going to send him home with me and stay near an emergency room? That's your advice?
Yeah.
And what they said is, look, if he can stay alive for 6 months, he'll get his liver transplant, you know? And so that was the goal, is to try to survive.
Man.
Yeah.
Man, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. And honestly,
when I went through opiate withdrawal immediately, like, well, my dad, I conned my dad into taking me to the hospital for shots of dope for like a week. Mm-hmm. And then he said he was on to me and he said, no more.
Yeah.
So I had to kick opiates in downstairs bedroom with my dog. Marley, one of them, and he his presence was the only thing that kept me from losing my mind. He's just this 95-pound strong, just handsome, thick, amazing dog. And yeah. And I was losing my mind. I was so scared, and I was having so much pain, and just feeling his chest raise and come down, and raise and come down. And, you know, that was so important for me to get through that. And then we got through it, and you know, the way I got involved in animal rescue when I got home is very strange because it was not planned. I didn't, you know, but I was so suicidal when I got home. I'd gotten through withdrawals and I was so physically ill and I looked so sick. And then I was required to go to meetings. So I started going to meetings and people wouldn't really get close to me. And I didn't know the first thing about meetings.
Yeah.
So I'm raising my hand every 5 seconds. I'm interrupting people. You know, my first meeting, the first recovery meeting I went to, we had the address. I can't walk really. And we walk in and the address is a bar. And I'm going, what is it? Can this be correct? And I'm like, all right, because we got to go in there. I have to send proof that I'm going to recovery meetings to Cedar Sinai. So we go in there and there's like three dudes sitting at a booth. And we're like, we go up to the waitress. We're like, we're here for the
recovery meeting. Bar?
Yeah. And she goes, oh, honey, you're in the wrong place. It's behind us. So the parking lot for the bar is where the recovery house was on South Street in Tehachapi.
My gosh.
So it's connected. And if you go to the address, that's where it will lead you. So that was the rude awakening to my first meeting. I very much so fell in love with recovery, but it took a while to sink in. And I was so sick looking, you know, I looked like the sickest sick person you've ever seen. You know, you're just green and yellow and just very sick. And, yeah. You know, like I said, ammonia on the brain. So you're not making a lot of sense. But, I'd started volunteering in 2002 at the Mojave Animal Shelter. My dad had a hangar at the Mojave Airport and I would spend a lot of time there just volunteering, working with the dogs, walking the dogs, talking to the staff, doing this, that, and the other. So I had quite a bit of, I knew I was drawn to that. And I had, you know, the suicidal ideations and just the pain of being alive was so robust. Like it was such a difficult thing to face every day. When you're really in that low of a low and you're in such a rut, sometimes the productivity that comes with thinking about suicide is helpful. If that makes any sense. Like I couldn't put one foot in front of the other when it came to anything in life. I was so bad at doing just about everything. But when it came to obsessing about taking my own life, I could do that. And it felt productive.
Yeah, my gosh.
Like if I end up doing this, at least I will remove this tremendous burden from my dad, from my family. I'm not going to survive anyway. So like, what's the point?
Yeah.
What is the point?
Yeah.
And what is the point to all of this suffering if I'm not going to survive anyway, you know? But my dogs had really been there for me in a really, really critical point. You know, I'd gotten through withdrawal and the next day I had pooped the bed, which happened all the time. And I was in the middle of the night trying to kind of get up and clean myself up. And there's a big mirror in the bathroom and I'm walking into the bathroom and I see myself and it's night and it's really bright, like light similar to the studio. And I'm just staring at myself in the mirror. Just like aghast at what was looking back at me, you know, like, at least up to that point, you know, we have a lot of moments and when we're strung out or when we're whatever, where we stare in the mirror, but I was stone cold sober staring in the mirror and having no clue who was looking back at me. Like just, I was not just perplexed, but I was completely taken back by what was looking back at me. You know, I just didn't, my eyes were all sunk in my head and real gray and bony and I was 45 pounds lighter than I am right now. And it was just like this very definitive message from God that I needed to leave this world, you know? And, you know, since I had ceased to exist, what was the point of trying to continue existing, right? And in that really difficult moment, my dogs were all lined up next to the toilet and all just looking at me like with such an affirming stare that just breathed all kinds of "you're going to be okay" energy into me. I mean, like, not just "you're going to be okay," but that they could recognize that I was still there. And
I was still you.
Yeah, I did not know where I was. I didn't know where my humanity was. I didn't know where my morals were. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I was feeling. I had such a hard time being alive. Such a hard time being alive, and I did not want to be alive. I didn't want to experience any more of it. I was so bad at it, and I just needed to go. And to have all my dogs looking at me like, "Hey, we know you're still there, bud." And not only are you there, but we're here. And that was a really big deal for me, because it was the first little bit of like feeling like more than just me. Even though my dad was very much helping me every step of the way, it was still my struggle. It wasn't his struggle. But the dogs really let me know, like, "Hey, we're going to do this with you."
Yeah.
Like, we are here for you, and whatever we can shoulder, we will. And but more so than that, that they recognized that there was still this faint flicker of flame inside that represented me and the love that I had in my heart and the kind of person that I was and the empathy and the sensitivities and the all these things that I knew at one point or another had existed in me, my dogs could recognize. And you know, that night I just journaled in my journal, and I took a picture of the sunrise, and we went for our first walk. And then just about every day for the next 2 years, I went on walks, multiple walks with those dogs in the mountains, just trying to develop a relationship with God and trying to literally put one foot in front of the other. And with that decision, everything changed. You know, I started to be able to go out in public. I started to be able to go to more meetings. I started to have a little bit of confidence. I'm bringing my dog with me everywhere. Marley's coming with me everywhere I go. So whatever intimidation I had about just existing out there in the world, he would help assuage that. He really canceled out a lot of the social anxiety and issues I was having, because he was this common denominator. Everybody loved him. It made conversations easier and helped me face a lot of those fears. And then I just started fostering dogs. I started bringing in dogs to my pack, and we started structured fostering. And you know, what a very unique thing about recovery alongside dogs, mutual rehabilitation, is that what a rescue dog needs is rules, boundaries, discipline, exercise, affection, and love. Mm-hmm. What a human in recovery needs is rules, boundaries, discipline, exercise, affection, and love. So as you're giving these qualities, as you're nurturing these qualities in your dogs, you're also giving them to yourself. And all of a sudden, I'm having routine, I'm having structured routine, I'm having healthy routine, I'm finding purpose. And the second I locked into my purpose, my body began to heal. The second I got out of this frequency of feeling profoundly sorry for myself, like I was the worst person on the face of the earth. That's the other thing people need to realize when you're dealing with addicts, is they know they are the worst person in the world. They don't need you to tell them. Yeah. You're not only your own worst critic, you're your own worst enemy in every sense of the way. And it doesn't need no profound one-liner from your aunt or your uncle or your high school coach is going to help you have some epiphany. Like, we know it. We just are helpless to do anything about it. That's the ism of the disease. But starting to live for my dogs and finding that purpose changed everything. Yeah. I started to be able to sleep. I changed everything that I put in my body. So no sugars, no complex carbohydrates, only vegetables, fruits, whole foods, and, you know, basically light meats, chicken and fish. Yeah. That's all we ate for 2 years. And at the time, I'm going to Cedar Sinai every 3 days. Sometimes every 2 days for checkups to make sure, because I'm that fragile. You know, I'm such a fragile dude. They need to know if something goes south and they need to admit me to the hospital. And I'm just getting better and better. And the Dr. Tran's like, "Man, we don't know what you're doing, man, up there in the mountains, but keep doing it, because you're getting better and this is remarkable." And I just kept getting better and kept getting better and kept adding dogs to my pack and started to get dogs adopted. And then I'm finding this creative outlet. So prior to dogs, I had no purpose other than feeding my own alcoholism. I had no creativity other than finding creative ways to get people to give me money, drugs, or alcohol. And all of a sudden now I have this tremendous purpose where there are real lives that are helping rebuild me that I'm rebuilding and sending on their whole new trajectory of hope. I'm starting to feel self-esteem for the first time in a very long time. And I still looked terrible. So there's no vanity involved. And even my self-esteem prior to that had to do with vanity. It's like, are you attractive to the opposite sex? But all of my self-esteem in this had to do with purpose, had to do with executing a purpose. And I felt so good that I was a part of something. And creatively, I'm taking their pictures, I'm writing their biographies, and they're all ridiculous. I'm making up stories for why these animals are incarcerated, you know? So it's not just like, you know, Tug is a yellow Labrador mix, the blah, 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 blah. It was like Tug found himself locked up at Kern County Animal Services for being out on a bender one night with his buddies. He ended up streaking and peeing in public, whatever, but just creating these outlandish stories and putting them up all over town. So I would print up all my posters, and I was doing this for the Humane Society, for Stop, for Canine Canyon Ranch. So I'm just volunteering for all these places and fostering as many dogs as I can, going to meetings as often as I can. And long story short, by the time I achieved 6 months of sobriety, I no longer needed a liver transplant. And the rest is sort of history. I mean,
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
That is so awesome.
And I'm still a transplant patient. I still go in every 6 months. I still go in for comprehensive imaging, liver MRIs and CTs and ultrasounds. And I'm one of only a handful of guys that have repaired their body basically entirely. I have what's called stage two fibrosis of the liver, which is a very light liver disease, which is unheard of to have been in stage failure and to have come back from that. So, I really hope that Cedars, I'm part of some studies there, and I've gotten connected with the National Association for Hepatic Doctors here in the United States. So I'm hoping to speak more on my history with, you know, alcoholism and liver disease, and try to provide some hope, because 50,000 people a year die of liver failure in the United States, which is astonishing. Yeah. And, you know, we have a reckoning when it comes to our relationship with alcohol and our relationship to liver failure that I don't think people really want to address. Certainly having sponsored many people in liver failure, I have seen how categorically most families are refused to address the root causes of what occurred. You know, a lot of people, when they pass from liver failure, the families won't even touch that it was alcohol related. You know, they do not want that stigma associated with their loved one, and they're not willing to talk about it. And, you know, so yeah, I'm still here in with my same old liver. And
that is so incredibly inspiring, though. Like, I'm glad you touched on, like, just looking at yourself in the mirror, not recognizing yourself, because I was going to ask you about that, because I kind of glanced on your Instagram, you know, and that piece of your story just brought me to tears. Yeah. Like, because that's what people need to hear, is that there's hope and you can change your life around, you know. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I mean, your story is seriously so inspiring.
Nice. It's one thing to be staring at yourself strung out, because we all do that, you know.
Yeah.
And like, maybe not necessarily recognizing what you see, but like to have that moment when you're sober, you know, I'll never forget it, because being connected to vanity as self-worth, I think a lot of us go through that, you know? And I remember looking at my butt, my naked booty, and it was like, it looked like a 95-year-old man's butt, because I'd been laying in a hospital bed for so long and I had no muscle tone. Uh-huh. And I just remember trying to like do one of these, and I couldn't believe how old, and I had this massive belly, you know. And when you're dying of liver failure, they drain your, so the reason you get this huge belly called ascites is when your liver and kidneys and pancreas and things, all your filtering mechanisms stop working, the blood and bile can't be filtered. So it just backs up. It's portal hypertension, and it backs up into your abdominal cavity. So then your abdominal cavity is just filled with this liquid that's extremely painful when it moves around. Yeah. And in order to deal with it, they have to stick a catheter in your back or in your stomach. It's called paracentesis, and drain it out of you. They just suck it out in this, with this vacuum. And then they put these liters of your own bodily waste in front of you, as if to say, look what we just pulled out of you, kid.
Oh,
you know?
My gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember one doctor in particular after a drain, you know, really tried to lay this guilt trip on me. Like, do you understand what you've done to yourself? Like, can you see, like, this is all coming from your body. And I was like, time and place, buddy.
Seriously.
I fully am aware.
I think I know. I'm trying my best here.
There were some cultural issues with that doctor where, you know, he just couldn't quite understand the disease of alcoholism.
Yeah.
You know, it was still just very much so viewed as a choice, as a conscious choice and a lack of will.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why we talk about it too, is just to bring the awareness that it is a disease.
Yeah.
And then it's not just a choice for everyone, you know?
Yeah.
So I kind of want to get into this to the dogs.
Let's
so
do it.
how did Marley's Mutt start after this?
Yeah, so after I found out that I wasn't going to get a liver transplant, that I didn't need one, I was already off to the races. I was working for all these nonprofit dog rescues and doing all this stuff and fostering. And they were like, you know, and at the time there were only purebred dog rescues. It was Dobie SOS for Dobermans, Westside German Shepherd, you know, there were specific breed mm-hmm. rescues. And we all had mutts growing up, right? And then yeah. Marley was like my pack general. He just kept the peace. He really knew how to not be pugnacious, you know, keep the calm, help instill confidence in insecure dogs. It was just incredible. And one of the staff at the Tatchby Veterinary Hospital, who were amazing, Tatchby Veterinary Hospital was a big part of getting things going for me. She's like, you should just do this. And I was like, do what? She's like, start a dog rescue. I'm like, what? Like, the IRS will never let a drunk in recovery with no like degree. I can't, you know, I didn't know how it worked back then.
Yeah.
So I thought there's no way they're going to let me do this. So I agreed with her, and she's like, you should call Marley's Mutts, since, you know, Marley's done, you help all the mutts. And I was like, okay, bet. Let's go.
Yeah.
So we started in Marley's Mutts in end of 2008, into 2009. And I didn't believe I was going to get approved by the IRS or the state franchise tax board. So I just set off to like proving my case. So I'm like, I'm going to have a year. I was organized as a DBA, so not a nonprofit, but I'm just going to hustle and get as many dogs as I can adopted. I'm going to create this amazing foster network. I'm going to start speaking at schools, doing all this stuff, and they won't be able to say no. And that's what happened. A year later, I got the letter back from the IRS, and they said, you're approved. And yeah, by that time, I was the drug addict in recovery, speaking at high schools, and including my high school in Redondo Beach, and up in Tehachapi and in Bakersfield. And Marley's Mutts was founded. And I think our big keys to success were a foster network, our community. The community of Tehachapi really stepped up. Tehachapi is an amazing, connected mountain community that really does care, and I think are uniquely outfitted to foster large dogs. And most of what we're euthanizing for space here in Kern County are large animals. So we started to make a real difference, and we started to help rescue ideology and ethos and this desire to address animal sheltering permeate that community. And everybody wanted to get involved, and they wanted to be part of the same purpose that I felt, you know, in that early recovery, helping me kind of get beyond myself and into purpose. Because you know, service is spirituality. People are always looking for these magical cures or entryways into spirituality. How do I get it? Do I talk to God? Do I pray? Do I meditate? How do I create that conduit? You create it by being of service. You serve something other than yourself. Whether that's dogs, whether that's kids, whatever community, you find a community to serve outside of yourself and to do so selflessly. And in that, it becomes extremely selfish,
yeah,
sort of, because you know, you reap the benefits. And that's what started to happen, you know, is just this incredible sense of community, incredible sense of purpose. We started to get so much momentum, and I very early started to create programs, because, you know, I created Marley's Mutts to address all of the issues of animal sheltering and rescue, all of those black eyes and low points and blind spots. I wanted to look at it all, look at the entire equation, come up with an equation, and address each variable to solve this problem. That's what I was going to do. I'm going to come in here, and we're going to change the way we go about this, because in my estimation, we're just saving one dog at a time. There's this drop in the bucket effect that is nonsensical because it's so inefficient.
Yeah.
So how can I create an animal rescue organization that is going to address all of the issues associated with the problem and come up with a solution? So we created Miracle Mutts, which is our educational program. We have a whole bunch of therapy dogs that we certified through, at the time, Liz Cover, who's an amazing dog trainer and therapist. So those dogs would go out to the hospitals here, all the schools here, various organizations, the Mission at Kern County, the Homeless Center, Hoffman Hospice. We trained a dog to live at Hoffman to take care, like all of these applications to get into the community and into the culture and explain why this is important. We created the Mutt Movers, which is rescue by relocation. So we're thanks to Motor City, shout out to John Petrie, we were able to get their bus and their van. So we're schlepping dogs to the Pacific Northwest, to Canada, to the Midwest. areas where they're not going to be euthanized, right? So we're addressing issues that way. And then we needed training. So that's, we needed to be able to train dogs in a fostering environment to be able to have the skills to get adopted and stay adopted.
Right.
Most of the dogs that are euthanized at the shelter are young dogs with no skills. So how can we advocate for them? That's how I created Positive Change, was wanting to have more fosters, more training for large dogs. Mm-hmm. And the prison system was the perfect application for that. So that's always been my goal, is not to just have these little dopamine hits of one rescue at a time, but to really culturally address why we find ourselves here, to implement practical strategies to move the needle, and then to apply what we did here elsewhere. And that's what I'm excited about moving forward to in my life, you know, now that I've left Marley's Mutts, is continuing to apply equations and solutions that I know worked here in Bakersfield to other regions of the of the state and of the country. And also, big shout out to Nick Cullen. Nick Cullen is our animal control director here in Kern County. And for any small entrepreneur who's getting into the field of animal rescuing and sheltering, it really helps to have somebody like Nick, who's a fearless leader, who also wants to work together with others to solve problems.
Yeah.
And we're just so lucky to have Nick as our guy here in town.
Can you talk a little bit more about like the prison system? Like what program was that with?
The prison program we created is called Positive Change. Mm-hmm. And I had selfishly just needed more fosters. We had 30 something fosters. I wanted more. I wanted to be able to save more, do more, help more. He also had a friend who had gotten out of prison. His name's Robbie Miller, shout out. Robbie, who runs Strength of Shadow Rescue here in Kern County. Robbie had just done 13 years, and we hooked him up with a dog that I was fostering. And it really just changed his whole life. He became the man he was always supposed to be. And Robbie was able to not just find a trajectory of hope and opportunity, but was able to inspire a lot of others, created an incredible organization where we really need one up in Lake Isabella. He's become a vocal thought leader and just vocal advocate in the space. And just seeing what that dog did to his trajectory, I knew we had to try to get in. So tried for a couple years, coordinating with Mr. Youngblood to work in the jail system here, not knowing any better. It's really hard to run dog programs in a jail, but we got our first break in 2015. Warden Long over at California City said, "We'd love to have you here. Come talk, you know, talk to all my correctional officers, pitch us, and we'll see what happens." And so we implemented January 2016, and the rest is history. It's a really special program. The essence of Positive Change is we're dealing with 30 student inmates, 10 dogs. Those dogs live for 3 months in the prison with their student handlers. We usually pair up those handlers outside of gang affiliations, outside of race, to encourage cooperation. And they are working towards either structured fostering or a specific curriculum to graduate. And there's a lot of prerequisites that you have to, a lot of boxes you have to check, a lot of things you got to do to succeed. And at the end of 14 weeks, we have a graduation. The dogs go get adopted, and then we bring in another batch, and we do it all over again.
Yeah, that's so cool.
And we've been able to operate Positive Change in a number of different applications that are very different. You know, we had the first ever girls juvenile program here and operated through Kern County Probation. They're just the amazing team at Kern County Probation allowed us to strike in with the Pathways girls. These are repeat offender girls. So we had dogs living at the girls prison here in Bakersfield at Juvenile Justice. And we've operated boys programs in Malibu. Those programs were taught by formerly incarcerated trainers.
Oh, okay.
So these are guys that did. Let me back up a little bit. One of the most heartening things about my experience in the prison system working with students and dogs is several of our best students were what we call juvenile lifers. These are guys who committed their loss of life offenses or participated in loss of life offenses as children, and they were sentenced to die in prison. So you're given an L at the end of your sentence, you're not going home, especially in the 90s. So a lot of these guys, you know, really worked hard for years within Positive Change, understanding that they would never go home. And then there was a bunch of different advancements in the code and in policy at the state level, some at the federal level as well, where if you were sentenced to essentially life in prison as a juvenile and you served 20 to 25 years, you would get a parole hearing. So it triggered an automatic parole hearing for these, because they basically determined that it's unconstitutional to sentence a child to die in prison, you know, for an offense they committed as a youth. So all of a sudden, a bunch of our guys are getting parole hearings and they're getting out of prison and they're joining the workforce as dog trainers here on the outside. So several of those guys, shout out Dante, shout out David Galavis, shout out Brian James, all, you know, would help us at the, they were teaching classes at the same juvenile facility they were at as kids. And now as free men teaching this class, we've taught at the federal level, a women's program at Victorville. We've had programs at Wasco, two at North Kern State Prison, Corcoran State Prison, most dangerous level 4 yard in California. We ran for 3.5 years. And it's been an incredible, wonderful ride. I've really discovered, it's kind of like purpose 2.0 for me. You know, purpose 1.0 was rescue dogs and really finding my purpose within their struggle. Mm-hmm. And then this 2.0 has been discovering the incarcerated and formerly incarcerated populations and really advocating for them. There's no better, no more wonderful group of individuals to advocate for than the incarcerated. And especially if you get to know them and believe in them and see them and feel them and love them and understand them. Yeah. They are so grateful for the time and application you give them, and their potential upside is so tremendous. You know, a lot of these guys have really forged incredible personalities, incredible resilience, incredible fortitude the likes of which, I mean, they've endured suffering the likes of which most of us can never imagine, you know, that they've been through for decades, surrounded by acute violence. And they've come out with not only their humanity intact, but with a more refined sense of humanity than most people I know. Mm-hmm. And I will always advocate for the incarcerated and the formerly incarcerated. And I'm not talking about blindly advocating. I'm talking about giving men and women a chance to redeem themselves who deserve it, and really hunkering down into spiritual principles. That could be spiritual principles related to Christianity, to Buddhism, Hinduism. Every spiritual pillar discusses and encourages working with the marginalized, the downtrodden, the criminal, I really hope that we can get back to that as a culture. You know, I still face a lot of uphill battles where I hear people saying, you know, why do you help these murderers? Why do you help these, as though they're just fundamentally terrible people who have no redemptive upside. And I'm telling you, the reason I help them is because I've seen the transformation that takes place and how quickly that transformation takes place. And I've seen how, when these guys apply themselves on the outside, there's no better advocate for, you know, juvenile incarceration. These guys really make a difference in their communities when they get out. And I'm very grateful to work with them.
Yeah, I think it's such a cool thing for you to just be able to spread hope to them too.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I just think it's a great
people lose sight mission. Of the, you know, people lose sight of the fact, a lot of people will say to me, you're just helping murderers and gang members, like, you know, get a life. Not really understanding that, you know, 11 million children are directly connected to incarcerated parents. Mm-hmm. You're not just giving that incarcerated individual a chance, you're giving their kids a chance.
Yeah.
You're giving their, you know, there's a wonderful story I love to tell that it's always hard for me to tell without crying, but shout out to Todd Olds. One of our students at California City, he had been in for 9 years. This is his third term in prison. He was just doing so great in class. We had a really hard dog named Reno. And he comes up to me one day and goes, hey man, check this out. And he hands me this letter. And it's a letter, and on one page is a snarling, horrific, drooling, mean dog, and it says dad. And then on the other page is a really nice looking dog, and it says like mom's new boyfriend, like the new guy. And then the contents of this letter, she's 9 years old writing him this. It says, I don't want anything to do with you. You're no longer my dad. I have a new dad. And I was like, geez, Todd, why are you giving this to me, man? This is this is so hard to read. Yeah. He goes, no, check it out. This was 9 years ago. This was when I first got here to Cal City. He goes, I just got this in the mail. And so what I just read was 9 years old. The letter I'm now reading is from his adult daughter, who's 18. And she says, Daddy, I saw what you're doing with Positive Change. I see you on the Instagram page. It's the first time she's seen pictures or videos of her dad. And she goes, I want to know all about Reno. And I, not only do I want to know all about Reno and the program, but I want you in my life because I deserve you in my life. And I'm so proud of you, you know. And Todd's gone on to, you know, get out of prison, train, I don't know how many dogs, gain too much weight. Sorry, Todd. really just be a model citizen who's trained a bunch of dogs for the fire department up there and just a really remarkable individual. And so many of our guys have done the same thing. We have 27 formerly incarcerated dog trainers in the streets working in behavior modification, working for rescues, shelters. And there's a really bright future, sure, in the dog training and behavior industry for our guys, but there's a bright future for so many formerly incarcerated because of what they've gotten through and been through, and what they can offer society,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Gosh, make me tear up over here. That is really, really, really cool though.
Yeah. And there's so many stories like that. Yeah. So many stories like that. I've been a part of some really beautiful, miraculous coming together of families. And, you know, at Positive Change graduations, when the families get to come in and sit with their loved ones and watch their dogs graduate. And, you know, I've got to be part of victims restitution, where students have confronted the family of those whose lives they've taken and brought, you know, had the dogs present and just some really profound, it is the bone marrow of life, working with the incarcerated and working with Positive Change, getting to be part of what is the bone marrow of life. It is the deepest, most realist, genuinely emotional, transformative. It's just so, you know, you're involved in the nitty gritty. You're involved in people's deepest, darkest secrets, their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations, what they hope to achieve, what they hope to leave behind. You know, it's a really wonderful, fulfilling, thick, rich, like environment to be in, you know, because it's never surface level. You're always in the depths of personal transformation. Yeah. And when you're in the depths of personal transformation, it's wild.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Gosh. Well, that is super cool. And I love your mission.
Thanks.
I really do.
Well, let me just jump in and say, so, obviously you can hear the passion in my voice and talking about or even mentioning leaving Positive Change is like really difficult for me, you know, because it's so much of my life. My entire sobriety is tied in with Marley's Mutts and Positive Change. So making the decision to leave the company I founded, you know, for ethical reasons that I will always stand on, that I will always stand behind and stand up for, and I'm sure will hopefully, you know, be discussed here in the future. I'll always be proud of myself, but it doesn't make it any less difficult.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure.
So I'm just working to create something new, something exciting. All my new programs are focused on trauma-informed learning and recovery. So we'll be doing dog training along with recovery. One of the things that's really missing in the prison system is the 12 steps. So one of the programs that we'll be implementing that Liz helped flush out is the 12 steps of dog training and 12 steps of recovery. So it's a 14-week long course, and we'll be flushing out, actually working the steps in prison on level 4 yards too, which have very little programming. Okay. So I'm really excited about that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And you don't have any names for anything
yet. No, not quite yet.
We're still working on that.
Yeah. I feel really blessed to be working in two specific fields that are incredible black eyes for our culture. And one of those, if you grew up in California, you know anything about the Central Valley, people would just say it's oppressively hot and there's dogs everywhere.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to the incarcerated population within America, you know, the United States of America incarcerates 25% of the world's incarcerated men, 33% of the world's incarcerated women. You know, until recently, 2.6 million people were incarcerated in the United States of America, which is just a shocking, not North Korea, not China, not Russia, not Laos, but the United States.
Yeah.
You know, we spend upwards of $100 billion a year on incarceration, upwards of $120,000 per year per inmate in California just to lock them up. That's just to lock people up. Mm-hmm. The amount of money that we're spending on this is truly catastrophic, with no real hope or end in sight in terms of restructuring the system. So being able to be involved in providing opportunity and fundamentally changing the trajectory of worthy people who have served decades in prison and who are coming home regardless is really fundamentally important for me, because our society has looked down on these people as castaways, as some lower caste that we ought not really entertain as fully human. And I'm here to tell you that the exact opposite is true, that some of what has been revealed to me by these individuals, and I know I've had 1,600 students, give or take, and gotten to know a lot of guys over a lot of years, and it is the most worthy group to advocate for, because I see what they can do on the outside. And I see not just that they're capable of change, but how they're capable of catalyzing making change in others and really becoming productive members of society. And what's most exciting for me and what I'm really going to engage the next 20 years of my life to is providing opportunity in the pet industry for incarcerated dog programmers. You know, what the incarcerated have always needed is a pillar of our American economy that will accept them. We had been promised oil and gas. We had been promised renewables. So in other words, you know, wind and solar were going to accept formerly incarcerated. None of it ever happened. But then we have the pet industry, which is a $120 billion recession-proof industry built on second chances that has shown itself to be more than willing to accept these individuals as viable contributors. And that's what I'm really excited about, is to develop more partners, more partnerships with companies, organizations, rescue shelters, so that they understand what kind of an asset we're working with here. The formerly incarcerated are not by definition deficits. In many cases, they are by definition assets because of what they've been through while they're down. You know, so my future is very much advocating for the incarcerated and formerly incarcerated and providing a trajectory of hope and opportunity for them so that they can contribute to our society and really reestablish themselves culturally instead of being viewed as such a black eye to our culture.
So what is life looking like now? What's Zach's future like?
Well, I've been crying in my pillow for the last three months. Really? No, I mean, it has, as a person in recovery, as someone who's coming up on 17 years without a drink, it has been brutal. I did not foresee leaving the company that I founded to be so difficult. I thought I would be set free to a certain degree emotionally, which I was. But it's all I've known in sobriety. And so all my patterns, routines, everything was turned on its head, and it's been extraordinarily difficult grappling with that. But, you know, my biggest goal in terms of animal sheltering and rescue has always been to make the biggest impact I can. And so I stumbled upon an organization called Caravita that reached out to me, that were putting together sort of a dream team of movers and shakers within the Los Angeles region to address the animal sheltering crisis, the true holocaust of animal that animal sheltering has become. So I signed on with Caravita like immediately, and their focus is large scale, high volume, targeted spay and neuter. So it's addressing the animal sheltering crisis through spay and neuter. There isn't a lot the animal rescue sheltering society kind of culture can agree on, but spay and neuter as being the primary moving variable, everyone agrees on. So we are endeavoring to accomplish as much as we possibly can in the realm of high volume spay and neuter and serving disenfranchised communities within Los Angeles, most of the communities where the dogs are coming from, where the surrenders are coming from, where the strays are coming from, and really giving them the spay and neuter resources they need to give us a shot at what they call no kill, less than 10% euthanasia of healthy animals.
Nice.
So yeah, I've been with Caravita for 2 months now. We just opened, in conjunction with CATC, we opened a clinic in Burbank. We've got a clinic in awesome. Lancaster, and those high volume spay neuter clinics are really going to be just a huge asset yeah. for the community. We're aiming at 25,000 spay neuters next year. And, I think we'll do it.
Well, I remember hearing very recently, even here in Kern County, that our shelters were like full.
Yeah.
So,
they're always full.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So I think that, yeah, that'll help. I mean, I see people, you know, breeding dogs all the time mm-hmm. that shouldn't be breeding dogs or just not taking the proper precautions to yep. get them fixed. And
yeah, the culture of, you know, the animal sheltering crisis is multifaceted. But yeah, sure. Part of it is cultural, and part of it is, you know, Kern County doesn't want to move beyond some of its, I mean, that you can still advertise. If you go to the Bakersfield, California newspaper, go to the back of it. You'll see 17 ads for $2,000 purebred dogs, almost none of which are purebred. They're all weird mixes. They're, you know, labradoodles of this sort, you know, Frenchie mix of this sort. The fact that the Californian even allows people to advertise those is beyond me. But so there's one thing I really wanted to talk with you about that I would be remiss if I didn't mention, and that is the mission at Kern County. A lot of the state has struggled with homelessness and how to address homelessness, how to address recovery, comprehensive, large-scale recovery. And my mom, the love of my life, hit rock bottom when I was 3 years sober, went from, you know, rehab to sober living to detox to this to that, just on the hamster wheel of recovery, really, really, really struggling. And the last time she got arrested, she got diverted from, she was at Mary Kay Shell at Kern Medical Center, And she became a number one draft pick for the mission at Kern County. And I said, what is this? What do you mean the mission? They said, well, your mom's going to avoid prison by going to the mission at Kern County, which is a religious discipleship program that she will have to serve a year in. And I heard that, and we grew up atheist, never been to church in my entire life. I'm hearing all this going, you've got to be kidding
me. Yeah, like there's no way.
You have got to be kidding me. And it was just one of those real teachable moments where you realize that not only do you not know everything, that in many cases I had zero idea what I was talking about. And the contempt prior to investigation was borderline criminal, because my mom found her entire life the minute she walked into the mission at Kern County. And watching her become part of the women's program for a year, and Carlos Baldovinos, bless his heart, and really everybody there, Steve, they welcomed me in and said, hey, Scal, like we love what you're doing with Marley's Mutts. You know, if you want to start working some things in here, we'd love to have you. It was really for me to get around the blackout period, because I wasn't supposed to see my mom for 3 months.
Oh, okay.
So to get around that, yeah. I could come with therapy dogs.
Yeah.
And we started the Mission Mutt program, which is their fostering. We would foster animals in the girls program. And my mom then became the women's program director, and then she would be awarded, you know, Woman of the Year through Sharon Grove's district. And to watch what the mission at Kern County achieved in my mother is just remarkable. And to see what's happened to so many other people who have been through that program. So I want to just take my hat off to Carlos and to everybody at the mission and say thank you for giving me my mama.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, we've kind of touched a little bit in previous episodes about the mission, but I just haven't heard much, honestly, about it. So,
yeah, it's a remarkable place because, you know, the issues with homelessness, a lot of people think homelessness has to do with not having a home. And in the throes of my addiction and alcoholism, if you would have given me a house, it would have done absolutely zero to help me in any way, shape, or form. It would have simply enabled me to have a place to do drugs more comfortably. And they really understand that the key to ending your cycle of homelessness is to address your addiction. And they do that first. And they have a structured, spiritually enriching way to do that. And I just really, being a person who was so against it when I heard about it, I mean, just anything related to religion, I was so against because I felt it somewhat culturally polluting. And I've developed a whole different approach to all of that moving forward, much more open-minded spiritually, including, you know, all kinds of stuff. So love you, Carlos. Love you, Steve.
I love that. Sorry, my answers. I love that. Sorry.
Oh, I love that.
But I do. I really do. I love the mission, and I love your mission, I should say, and the mission. So I guess before we end here, is there any piece of advice you'd want to give anybody? Anything?
Anybody in recovery?
In recovery, anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So the advice I would give to all of you people out there who are sober, curious, but are terrified of the word of God, meaning just the word God, not the word of God, who just don't like hearing the word God associated with anything having to do with sobriety. I was you. I feel the exact same way. I was a militant atheist growing up. I very much enjoyed being able to dismantle theists in conversation and things like that. But I wanted to explain something that's a really beautiful aspect of recovery, like a really fundamental, beautiful opportunity that's given to you if you embrace recovery. And that is to discover a God of your understanding, not to take someone else's on, not to read it in a book and extrapolate, but to develop a God of your understanding that can mean any number of things that are born of your experience in life, of the things you read, of the relationships you have, of the beauty you take in, of the miraculous moments you experience, of the suffering you endure. And it doesn't have to be anybody else's. It doesn't have to be one you discover in church. It doesn't have to be one you read in the Bhagavad Gita. It doesn't have to be any of that. All it has to be is a power other than you, a power greater than yourself. And if you start to pray to that power, if you start to root into that, if you start to meditate to that frequency, to that idea, to the idea of giving something away, of surrendering what it is that you're holding to a power greater than yourself, and to just allow yourself the freedom to discover it. Discover it in your walking meditations. Discover it when you're playing with your kids. There is a frequency there's a frequency of godliness that you can tap into that has nothing to do with, like I said, Christ, Buddha, Vishnu. It is of your own making, and that's such a beautiful path to walk because it's nobody but your own. And it's a really terrific experience, and it's a cure to loneliness that will be with you for the rest of your life if you engage with it. And try not to be afraid of the word God. You can call it whatever you want, as long as it's not you, you know? And I really encourage people to embrace the opportunity at that development, to embrace that potential relationship, because that petrifying, aching loneliness that we carry with us, we don't need to. And there are options and opportunities to share it with others in a really productive, meaningful way that will make everybody's lives better, you know?
I'm going to touch on this because it's already making me emotional. Because
I love that.
That's what helped me out. I love your answer or your response. That's what helped me out too. I mean, not out, but just through my really tough time after I lost Kyle. Kyle was just, he talked about God a lot, but I always believed in God. But I never went to church. I didn't ever have a real relationship with God. But yeah, right after he died, for whatever reason, I was like, I got to get to church. And I don't know why that just popped in my head right after. And like you said, it doesn't have to be in church. It doesn't have to be where you discover your God and your spirituality. But that was something that really helped me through the darkest time of my life, was finding God and having a relationship with God and finding, like, what am I going to do now? You know, and I needed to lean on God more than I ever have in my entire life. And I truly, truly believe that that is what has helped me through and has helped me to get to where I am today.
Yeah. You have two paths diverged in a wood, and you chose the road less traveled. You know, a lot of people, like you said, or like you alluded to with the name of this podcast, will suffer in silence, and they will eat their sorrow, and they will eat their suffering, and it will bottle up, and it will come out in terrible ways at your children and at other things. And then there's, you know, there's opportunities to shatter your silence and to let it out. And, yeah, spirituality gives you an opportunity to do that in a very non-judgmental way. I broke down in church on Sunday, full on. We have like incredible worship music that's almost unfair because it is like this radical conduit to a higher frequency. And like a song, we have 5 songs to kick it off. It's like 25 minutes of worship music. One and a half songs in, I'm going, I'm done. This is about, and I'm by myself. I usually bring my kids, but they're with their mom. And woof, I just, for 3 songs, just cried. And I was hyperventilating. I mean, not like terribly, but bad enough, you know, and I'm just breathing. But it was lovely and it was very cathartic. And I never, ever in my life did I imagine I would be the dude or a dude or anybody who could be at church with their eyes closed in their pocket. Never. That just, me seeing a video of that would make me embarrassed. Yeah. So to actually be the guy doing it is... But it's also a big ego check for me too, because previously I'd have been like, oh, there's no way I can let other people see me crying in church.
Yeah.
No way. And it was really special. It was a really cathartic, wonderful moment. And I took that little connection and tried to cultivate it more later that day when I was doing my meditations and
Yeah. I mean, I never thought that I would be that person either. I'm like, oh my gosh, I feel so weird going into church and seeing these people like raise their hands, and I'm like, hallelujah. I feel so embarrassed, you know. And I felt the same way. I was like, there's no way that could ever be me. And you know, it brought my whole family into church with me after that too. So like my parents, my sister, my brother-in-law, even my aunt and her boyfriend, and you know, it just like, it's something that just really, really helped all of us through tough time.
Yeah, me too. Me too. And my mom really led the way. My mom gave me permission because it worked so much in her life. The mission, and my mom gave me permission because it wasn't supposed to rhyme, but clip it if it did.
Yeah.
You know, really, because Yeah, I just the simple idea that you don't have to take in wholesale every bit of information related to this, that, or the other religion was so helpful to me. You know, that I don't, there's not going to be some test later.
Yeah.
That if
yeah.
I don't get the thing that I'm like spiritually kicked out of the group.
Exactly. Well, I really, really appreciate you coming on, sharing your story, sharing your mission, and honestly, just giving a lot of people this hope that, that their life can turn around.
Yeah. You're very welcome. I got to give you a huge set of props and like how remarkable it is that you have taken this loss and leveraged it into something that can help other people. And it takes a tremendous amount of guts to just sit here with a random person you don't
Thank
know
you.
Is difficult to do, as we all know.
Yes.
Try doing an opening. But yeah, for you to be doing what you're doing and sitting through it and feeling it all and allowing yourself to be emotional, like you're on the right path, girl.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of Shattered Silence. As always, you could watch full episodes on YouTube or listen on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Don't forget to follow us on all of our socials on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok.